So it's my pleasure today to share with you the work we're doing in Connecticut around monitoring HPV vaccine impact. Thank you, Heidi, for organizing this. I want to tell you about two things we're doing today, different but related projects. One is, as Heidi mentioned, I want to share with you the work we're doing around our multi-centered CDC-funded project to monitor HPV vaccine impact. Basically, what we're doing is setting up and implementing a laboratory-based surveillance system for cervical cancer precursors. So those of you who are in the morning session heard a little bit about this from Susan, who's over there. What I hope to do today that will be a little bit different is just share with you some of the practical aspects of implementing this project and talk a little bit about some site-specific area, how Connecticut's a little bit different from some of the other sites. The other thing I want to do is share with you the work we've done around adding cervical cancer precursors to our state list of mandated reportable diseases, which was pretty cool, so that'll be fun. The first point I want to make relates back to Heidi's point around collaboration. And this is a very busy slide because we've been very busy, many of us, working on this project. This is really only the tip of the iceberg. I'm not going to go through and name everybody, but I do just want to mention that our work in Connecticut has really been anchored at our Emerging Infections Program site, which is a CDC-funded site. In Connecticut, our EIP is a collaboration between our Connecticut Department of Public Health, several people there, and Yale University, the School of Public Health, where I'm affiliated. We've also, you'll see as I go through this, you'll see that we've developed a lot of new collaborations as well as a result of this work. Most notably, we're working with all the pathology labs in Connecticut, including hospital-based and private ones. And we also have many national partners, including the folks at the CDC who have been instrumental in getting this off the ground, other EIP sites, so lots and lots of people. So the purpose of the EIP project is to develop and implement a laboratory-based reporting system for cervical intraepithelial neoplasia grades 2 and 3, or SIN2 and SIN3, and adenocarcinoma in situ. So I think the majority of us are in agreement that to monitor cervical cancer, that as an outcome is going to take too long. So we're looking at something a little more proximal. This is sort of midway. We're not looking at PAP results or HPV testing, but cervical cancer precursors. Again, these are going to be more prevalent than looking at cervical cancer and more proximal. Our specific aims are to monitor trends in these diagnoses over time. Hopefully we'll see them go down. We also feel that it's important to monitor trends in HPV type-specific SIN2, 3, and AIS diagnoses. The idea here is that as the vaccine protects from type 16 and 18, the thing we want to monitor is whether or not the other oncogenic but less prevalent HPV types maybe go up in frequency. So we feel that that's important to monitor as well, though there is some cross-protection, so that's good news on that front. We also want to estimate and describe the vaccination patterns and screening history among the cases, the women who are reported with these diagnoses. So quick overview, this is about all that will be redundant from this morning, is that we are currently funded for 2 years to do this work, which is really around the development and implementation that we expect the project will last for many, many more years. At 4 EIP sites, we're doing this in Connecticut, New York, Tennessee, and California. Each site has a well-defined catchment area. It's typically the county level. In Connecticut, we're doing this in New Haven County. And again, we're setting up a laboratory-based surveillance system for SIN2, SIN3, and AIS. So what we're doing is we're going to have all cases from pathology labs in Connecticut reported on a one-page case report form, getting some very basic demographic information. And then for a subset of cases, we are going to be doing enhanced surveillance to get more detailed information. Again, coming back to the specific aims I mentioned previously, we want to know more about the vaccine status and screening history of the cases. And we're also going to be collecting specimens, some of the cervical biopsy tissue, to send to the CDC for typing to address the second aim that I mentioned. So our protocol, very briefly, this is conceptual at this point. We're just beginning this work, but we think it'll be just fine. We're going to have all the pathology labs send case report forms on women with these diagnoses to the Yale Emerging Infections Program office. And I'm going to talk more about this in the second half of my talk when I talk about the reporting, the state-based reporting. But basically, for people, there we go, who are residents outside of New Haven County. So this is not part of the catchment area for the EIP work. So for residents outside of New Haven County, we'll verify the diagnosis is reportable and enter this into our statewide surveillance database. And again, I'll come back and talk about that in a minute. Interestingly, so we started this project, essentially became effective January 1 of 2008, and the very first case we got was a SIN-1, which did not meet our eligibility criteria. So our first, so verifying that the diagnosis is reportable is apparently going to be an important step. For residents of New Haven County, so this is our catchment area, we'll do the same thing, verify that the diagnosis is reportable, enter this into our state database, so statewide we're getting all of these diagnoses. And then we'll do the enhanced surveillance on a subset of women aged 18 to 39. We're going to contact the labs and ask them to send some of the biopsy tissue, again, to the CDC for typing. We also need to do the enhanced surveillance around finding out more about the vaccination status and screening history of the cases. So to do this, we plan to do whatever we need to do. We will either call the provider and talk to the provider, see if we can get the information. We may do medical record reviews, and we may also contact the patients as we need to get this additional information. So just so backing up a little bit, so this is our protocol. So now I want to just talk a little bit about what we've actually done to get this protocol to work. So the first thing was to identify the labs that we need to send the case report forms to the Yale EIP office. So we didn't know what the labs were. So to figure out which pathology labs process cervical biopsy specimens for New Haven County residents, we conducted a provider survey. So this was a telephone survey. We called up providers. We have lists of providers. We called up all OBGYNs practicing in our catchment area and a sample of internal medicine providers, family practice docs, and other people. Like, for example, we called the Planned Parenthood Health Centers as well. So we just talked to providers and said, do you do biopsies? If so, where do you send them for processing? So we identified in our catchment area 11 laboratories, 11 pathology labs that process cervical biopsy specimens. 8 of them are hospital-based and 3 are commercial. And the large ones in our catchment area appear to be the Yale New Haven Hospital Lab and Quest, a private lab. So then we had our list of 11 pathology labs working in our catchment area, and so we needed to essentially approach them and talk to them about this project and the fact that we now are going to be asking them to do these case report forms and send them to us. So initially we just called them up, explained the purpose of the project, what we're doing and why we're doing it. And then we set up a follow-up meeting to discuss implementation of the project. So I just want to share a couple of points here on developing these partnerships. So we're fully cognizant of the fact that we're now asking people to do something for us, and we're not paying them. There's no tangible immediate benefit to them. And so we're very aware of that. So one of the things we've done as we've been talking to the labs is to really emphasize flexibility in reporting and making it as easy for them as possible. So I think a little bit like Cosette mentioned, but maybe a little bit different than Carla, we're really allowing the labs to report this however they would like. They can do it electronically, they can do it on paper, they can put it on a disk, we'll go pick it up. So this is actually an update for my colleagues in the room. We just got our first set of reports from one of the hospitals in New Haven City. They ran a report for the month of January, and we got 26 cases, and she gave me a stack of papers like this, and that was their way of reporting. And I went to her office, I picked it up. So people can do it on paper. We do hope, it is our goal, to make this a little bit more systematic and electronic, but initially, again, we're just trying to make it as easy for people as possible. Our primary objective is to get the reports. So whatever is easy and works for folks, we're willing to accept. We also like to emphasize the important role that the labs play in this. We really want, they're pathologists, and this is their business, and it's not my business, and I don't know what they do. I'm an epidemiologist, not a pathologist. So we really want them to feel like their expertise are valued, and they are valued. So we talk a lot with the pathologist about this, needing and wanting their input into the scientific components of this project. And the benefit to the lab. So we're happy to share information back with the labs that we get from the surveillance system. The other thing we felt was important was just to talk about the public health significance of the work we're doing. And this is something that I'm really happy to say didn't take a lot of convincing. The labs that we've talked to have been really, really excited and very, very supportive and more than willing and happy to participate in this. So the reception we've gotten from the labs has been really quite good. So quickly, this won't take long, I want to talk a little bit about the disease reporting issue. So just some quick background. I'm sure you're all aware that all states have lists of reportable diseases that are considered to have public health importance. And these lists vary from state to state. And ultimately, what gets reported to state health departments ends up at the CDC, but those lists are actually developed at the state level, not at the national level. So we recognize, and folks in Connecticut recognize that the system really needs to be flexible in order to conduct surveillance for new conditions when they arise. So for example, in Connecticut, Lyme disease was a big one. HIV is obviously a big one everywhere. So this list needs to be flexible to address these emerging concerns, but the process of approval by the legislature, which is how most states do this, can be cumbersome, sometimes politically motivated and time-consuming. It can take years for the legislature to approve adding or deleting something from the list of reportable conditions. So in 1985, the Connecticut General Statute that talks about disease reporting was amended to include a statement that the Commissioner of Public Health will annually issue a list of reportable diseases and reportable laboratory findings and amend such a list as he or she deems necessary. So essentially, what we've done in Connecticut is we've eliminated the need to go through the state legislature to change the list of reportable diseases. It's really up to the Commissioner of Public Health to do this. And so this law made Connecticut unique at the time in our flexibility to adapt this list. So the process by which we do this is that our state epidemiologist, who, by the way, talking about public health champions, Jim Hadler is our state epidemiologist, and he's a public health champion of mine. He is really the one who was responsible for getting SIN2, 3, and AIS reportable in Connecticut. So the state epidemiologist selects and convenes an advisory committee to make recommendations to the Commissioner of Public Health. So even though the amendment to the statute, the point there was to sort of take this process out of the hands of the legislature and put it into the hands of public health officials, they also still did recognize there needs to be some oversight. So it's not just the commissioner, but the state epidemiologist convenes this committee to make recommendations. So the advisory committee is composed of representatives from groups of people that do the work of reporting. So for example, lab directors and hospital epidemiologists are on this committee, and other stakeholders like public health officials and health department staff. So the committee comes together annually. They do this every year in December. They discuss the proposed list of changes. They take a vote, a majority wins, and based on a majority vote, recommendations are made to the commissioner, who can then approve or reject this recommendation. And this happens before January 1st of every year, and then the lists are disseminated. So we did this in December of 2007, again, largely an initiative of Jim Hadler, our state epidemiologist, decided to consider adding SIN2, 3, and AIS to our list of reportable diseases. Now, this was a little bit different. Most diseases that are reportable are communicable and infectious, and the idea is that you need to know who's infected so they can be treated and you can find their contacts. So this was a little bit different. But the idea behind making this reportable is that it was the vaccine. So a lot of vaccine preventable diseases have been added to the list, like varicella and pneumococcal disease are a couple of examples. So the idea was we really wanted to be able to evaluate vaccination efforts. Our state is putting a lot of time and effort into this, mostly through the Vaccines for Children program. So this was the rationale. We went to the committee. We had a meeting in December, and the committee raised, so these are the stakeholders, and the committee raised some interesting issues. The first thing they wanted to know is, well, doesn't this overlap with the tumor registry? So we explained that the tumor registry is for cervical cancer. In fact, SIN3 used to be reportable to our tumor registry, but that hasn't been done in a while now. So we explained that this was different, again, more proximal and more prevalent, so important. Another thing that was raised as a concern was around specimen collection. Some of the lab directors said, well, what if we can't give you specimen? What if we don't have enough? Or what if we want to keep our specimen for legal or liability issues? So we changed the language in the reporting guidelines to say that if available, the labs will provide us with specimen. People were also concerned about patient confidentiality, the idea that we'll be calling up some of the cases to ask questions about screening history and other things. And when we explained that this is something that's routinely done for a lot of other infectious diseases, people were much less concerned. So the outcome was that this was recommended to and accepted by the commissioner. So in Connecticut, as of January 1, 2008, SIN2, 3, and AAS were reportable. So I know you can't read this, I can't even read it, but I just want to show you, this is the Connecticut epidemiologist, this is the newsletter that went out in January of 2008, and you can't really read it, but here it says, changes to the list of reportable diseases and laboratory reportable significant findings, HPV-related cervical neoplasia added. So this newsletter went out to all of the labs in Connecticut so that people are aware that this is now reportable, and we're now in the process of following up with all these labs. Now that they know it's reportable, following up with them to talk about how best to implement it. And that is where we are with our project. So there's lots more that I would love to share and lots more that I could say, but I'll stop in the interest of time. But I do want people to feel free to contact me if you have any sort of Connecticut-specific questions. And that's it. Sure.